I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. We humans pride ourselves on being highly evolved, and in many ways we are, compared to our ape ancestors. But we can't entirely escape our hunter and gatherer heredity. Our guest Rick Shankman believes that our instincts get us in trouble when it comes to our politics. He's the author of Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. He draws on neuroscience and evolutionary psychology to explain why, as voters, we believe things that aren't true, why politicians get away with lies, why voter turnout is so low, why gut feelings often win out over rationality and facts. Rick Shankman is author, historian, founder of the History News Network. That's a website devoted to historians discussing current events. This is his seventh book, and he joins us from the NPR studio in New York. And Rick Shankman, nice to have you with us on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So what's distinctive about our Stone Age brain, as you describe it?
Well, it was designed to meet the problems of the Stone Age, which was a 2.5 million year long period. And that's really when our brain evolved. And what evolved along with everything else were what social scientists refer to as evolved psychological mechanisms. And these are basically, when you think of human nature, that's what we're talking about. So human nature evolved during that period. And while our brain and our bodies are still evolving, evolution didn't just stop 10,000 years ago with the end of the Stone Age. The bulk of our evolution occurred during the Stone Age. So our brain is not really designed to meet the problems of the 21st century, and that gets us into terrible trouble in politics, and that's why I wrote this book.
But it's interesting to compare, I mean, certainly advances in science and technology, psychology in many ways. We are highly evolved when it comes to that. What is it about politics that seems to connect us to our primitive selves?
In politics, if you don't have a lot of information, you're going with your gut. If you are designing a building and you're an engineer or an architect, you're going with the information you have gathered in school and study. In politics, you don't have to have any kind of degree when you show up at the polls to vote. So most of the time, people aren't studying politics. They're just going with their gut. And the problem is their gut misleads them.
And why is that? I mean, what's wrong with our gut?
Well, in the book, I tell about four different problems. Let's start with the first one that I focus on, which is apathy, which is so common in the American electorate. In the last election, the midterm elections of 2014, something like 37% of eligible voters voted. Now, that's deplorable. So why did that happen? Mm. What's going on here? Well, we were designed to live in communities of 150 people, not millions of people. And with these elections involving millions of people, we don't care. We don't care about the fate of all these other people. We care about our small, little local communities. And when I say local, I don't mean like your small town that you happen to live in. I mean the people directly around you that you interact with every day. That's what our gut instinct tells us. And because we're not doing that when we go off to the polls, a lot of us are, meh, who cares about this election?
Well,
that's a problem.
Let me stop you there, because that may be true in this country, but if you look in other countries, other democracies where people do vote, those numbers are much, much higher. We see people standing in line, you know, for hours in order to cast a vote. Is it something about this country or our evolution in this country, our politics?
If you go on instinct, I think you're going to tend to be apathetic in a mass democracy. But what these other countries are doing that we're not particularly good at is creating a culture of civic responsibility. And also their systems are set up in such a way that there's a reward for voting. They've got in parliamentary systems a system that's in effect basically where your vote has a lot more impact than it does when you're voting, say, in a congressional district where you know that your congressman has always been a Republican because you live in a Republican district. And if you're a Democrat, you might as well not bother showing up at the polls. So there's kind of institutional forces. And here's a point I want to really make clear right off the bat, which is just because our biology indicates that we are going to be apathetic given the fact that we've got this Stone Age brain and we're living in the 21st century doesn't mean that we are fated to be apathetic. And the reason is culture. Biology changes very, very slowly. Culture changes really, really rapidly. I just gave a talk at the Smithsonian last night. One of the points I made is that 100 years ago, exactly 100 years ago, down in Waco, Texas, people lynched a black man, and they castrated him, they cut off his fingers, they burned him, and they killed him. And they did it in front of a crowd of tens of thousands of smiling, cheering people. There's a photograph that shows the immensity of the crowd who turned out for this. And on their faces are smiles. In 100 years, we've gone from that to where today people would be appalled at a lynching. So culture is changing very, very quickly. And that's where I think we can be very, very hopeful.
Well, let me go back to some of the other findings that you come up with in this book, which is that we're often not very good at, sizing up our political leaders. Explain that to us.
We don't read politicians really, really well, and we need to. And that's a big problem because when we go in the voting booth, most of the time we're not voting on policy, we're voting on the person because we don't know what issues there are going to arise. So we kind of just do a shortcut and we say, I like this guy or I don't like this guy. Or even in the case of George W. Bush, I'd like to have a beer with this guy. Well, there are many problems with this. But the problem that I'm focused on in the book is how we misread people. And it's obvious that we do misread our politicians. Richard Nixon got elected to the vice presidency twice. He was twice elected president of the United States. And then Watergate happened. And then people said, oh, now I really get Richard Nixon. His critics for years have been saying, hey, you got to understand this guy. He's a slime ball. But the American people didn't catch on. So what's going on there? Why do we read politicians badly? And, oh, by the way, this isn't just Republicans who are reading politicians badly. There were a lot of Democrats who were misled about John Edwards back in 2004 when he ran. We all thought, he had this a wife who looked real. He looked a little bit like a Ken doll, but he had this wife who looked real. And we made all these assumptions about him. And we were wrong. We didn't know anything about his marriage or who he was or what his character was like or what was really going on in his life. So here's the problem. When we look at people, we have an instantaneous read on them. And our brain plays a trick on us. After we see somebody for just a couple of times on television, maybe it's in a five-second soundbite here and another 10-second soundbite there, we think that we know them because they're familiar. And this worked for us in the Stone Age. Why? Because if you encountered somebody a few times and you emerged from the encounter, okay, they didn't try and attack you and kill you, well, then it was good that your brain sent you a message that, yeah, you know this person. At least you knew one thing about them. You knew that your life was probably not going to be threatened by an encounter with this person. But here's the part that we don't make the connection with. Back in the Stone Age, we lived in these small communities of 100 to 150 people. We knew everybody. We knew them because we lived with them. We worked with them. They were almost inevitably somehow related to us. They were part of our kin. So the context was totally different. Today, we don't know these politicians. All we know is fleeting glimpses of their face that we catch on TV. But our brain plays a trick on us. It says, you know them. And that's a disconnect. There's a mismatch between our brain today and what it's telling us and our brain back during the Stone Age and what it was telling those people. And it's two separate things, but we think that we really know people, and that's why we keep being called up short. So what I recommend in the book is a flare should go off in your brain anytime you're looking at a politician on TV and you think, yeah, I really know this person. And you really do think that. We all think that. We really in our gut think this. A flare should go off in your brain saying, I really don't know this person.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things. One about Richard Nixon, as you write in the book, you were a longtime supporter of Richard Nixon when it was pretty clear to a lot of other people, including the press and a lot of other people even beyond the press, that he was a crook. But you stuck by this guy. Why do you think that was?
Well, in part, I think I wrote this book because I always wanted an answer to that question. It's haunted me for 40 years. Why did I stick with Richard Nixon? So there's a couple of reasons. There's a lot of reasons. I mean, it's basically a 300-page book to help explain myself.
So what
to
is
myself.
The reason there, Rick Schickman?
All right, so let's boil it down. So one is just pure, plain confirmation bias. I was a well-informed voter. I was a student at Vassar College, and I was following politics constantly. I was keeping up on all the Watergate news. I knew all the facts. But confirmation bias is all about discounting facts that are contrary to your belief. And that's what I was doing. Every time something came up that was contrary to my belief, my confidence in Richard Nixon, I just kind of discounted that fact. And I didn't place an emphasis on it. And we know from studies that social scientists, neuroscientists, Drew Weston conducted a few years ago, that our brain actually rewards us for this confirmation bias. If you're a fan of John Kerry back in the 2004 election and you heard good things about John Kerry, your brain rewarded you. If you heard bad things about him, the bad information would come into your brain and your brain would have an automatic default position. Instead of trying to deal with the bad information and try to decipher it and understand it, it would shunt it aside. And then you'd get a little reward in the reward center of your brain, which would say, oh, that's good. That dissonance has gone away. That bad feeling I just had, that's gone away.
And so it becomes reinforcing.
Yes, exactly. So this is the confirmation bias. The larger bias here is just partisan bias. Basically, belief trumps facts in the human brain. So anytime you are in a situation where you've got a pre-existing belief and you're hearing contrary information, your brain's going to figure out a way to have your beliefs come out on top. And why is that? Because we do not privilege the truth. We want to survive, and part of survival is pushing our version of the truth. We just want our own version of the truth to prevail.
Well, hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break. And that's Rick Schickman, our guest in this hour of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. He's got a new book. It's called Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. This is his seventh book. His previous titles include Just How Stupid Are We? Facing the Truth About the American Voter and Presidential Ambition, Gaining Power at Any Cost. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Does it sound like you? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Rick Schickman about his new book, Political Animals, and about how, as he just said, that belief really trumps facts when it comes to politics. And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Rick, going back to this notion that belief trumps facts, and we'll talk about Donald Trump in a little bit, I'm thinking of these truth-o-meters and these fact-checking sites as a way to try to hold candidates to some level of honesty, but also to give voters information about candidates and correct them when they are wrong. Are you saying that these things really just don't register with people?
Most of the time, they don't register with people. Our brain figures out a way to absorb the information and discount it and then discard it and throw it away and not worry about it. But I heartily embrace the news media attempt to do this. It's got to be done. In a democracy, we can't give up on reason. if we give up on reason, we might as well give up on democracy and say what we need is a philosopher king to take over because we're not able to govern ourselves. And even the philosopher king, he's going to have all kinds of biases. So it's just hopeless. The whole thing is hopeless. But obviously, you don't want to take some nihilistic approach like that. So we've got to amble along as best as we can. It's the old line about democracy is like a boat where you're taking on water. It's like a raft. You're taking on water a little bit. Your feet are always getting wet, but it doesn't sink. So you just keep on rowing along.
Well, it's kind of depressing, I have to say. But we will keep on with our conversation here. Just a quick question. So at what point, as you said, did you realize that Richard Nixon was the crook that he was? When did you realize that?
Well, the so-called Saturday Night Massacre, where he fires the attorney general and then dismisses a bunch of people because they didn't want to fire Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor who was taking Nixon to court and demanding access to the Watergate tapes. That knocked me for a loop, but I still stuck with Nixon all the way. In fact, I was even the vice chairman of the Bergen County, New Jersey Committee to Save the Presidency. And I stayed on that committee until 2 months before Nixon resigned. Now, if you were alive back then and you remember your history, you know by then the American people had really, by that point, abandoned Nixon. But I held on all the way until then. So that's some powerful confirmation bias.
Well, and maybe stubbornness on top of that. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but you have an interesting little section on the Nixon Library and how that tells a kind of counter narrative to the Nixon presidency, not including some of the things that you were just talking about.
Yeah, it's a chapter that I call It's Still Like It Was 1974.
Right.
The Nixon Library was established by Richard Nixon and his family under a family-controlled foundation. And then finally, around 2005 or so, the federal government took control, as it has taken control of virtually all the presidential libraries, because they can't go on their own. They're just too expensive, so they need taxpayer dollars behind them. And when the federal government took over, they said, hey, the Watergate exhibit that you guys have had since 91 when the museum opened is partisan, it's inaccurate, and has to go because it basically reflected Richard Nixon's view that he was a victim of a lot of nefarious forces and he really didn't do anything wrong. Or he did a little bit wrong, but nothing that constituted high crimes and misdemeanors that would have led to his impeachment and removal from office. And now, by the 21st century, this was a ridiculous approach to history. And the federal government said, you got to get rid of this Watergate exhibit. It's an embarrassment in a federal institution. Timothy Naftali, the highly esteemed historian who was put in charge of the Nixon library, said, it's got to go. And the Nixon people said, yes, we agree, it's got to go. But they never could come up with a new exhibit. And they couldn't come up with it because they could not get their heads out of 1974. So basically what happened was the federal government came in, it dismantled the old exhibit, and the federal government established a new Watergate exhibit.
Hmm.
But this tendency of a small group of people whose views are not filtered through a larger medium of intellectual exchange with people outside that small group, they could not evolve. Their views could not evolve, and they were still stuck back in 1974. And there's a lesson in that for all of us, and we shouldn't just be condescending and think, oh, you know, they're a bunch of Nixon loyalists, blind. It's true of all of us. This is what happens to all of us when we get trapped in a small group. So here's the lesson. The lesson is, before you join a group, make sure that it's not a small, reinforcing, self-reinforcing group of like-minded people unfiltered by dissenting opinions, because what's going to happen is it tends to become more and more extreme over time. This is how we can get control of our instincts. We know that our instinct is if we join a small group of like-minded people, we're going to wind up going down a rat hole. So you want to avoid that by not joining those kinds of groups, because you then can control what's going to happen to you yourself, so that you're not just kind of taken along, swept along by the group and becoming extreme.
But don't you think there's something very tribal about politics? I mean, whatever someone's politics are, or even from country to country, because you identify with people who have the same kind of beliefs that you do.
Politics is tribal, and that is one of the problems and one of the forces that I'm trying to draw attention to in my book. So I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying that I think we can do better.
Well, help us. I mentioned Donald Trump, but I think it's important to talk about him in the context of what you are talking about. And again, this is a candidate that when he announced, everyone thought, you know, well, this will last for a couple of weeks. And now we find, at least nationally speaking, he's a front runner when it comes to the Republican candidates. Does your book help us understand the rise, the appeal of Donald Trump?
I think it does. And, of course, I wrote the book before he announced for the presidency, so it's not like this book was written to answer Donald Trump. But I think the book comes out at a convenient time to help us understand this whole Trump phenomenon. I was not shocked that when he started going after Muslims and Mexican murderers and rapists and the whole diatribe, I wasn't shocked that that resonated with people. Because what is politics all about? Politics is not about candidates. As much as the media focus on the candidates, it's actually about the voters. And do the voters feel smart or dumb or something in the presence of a politician of one stripe or another? And the people who Donald Trump is mainly appealing to, who are the so-called low-information voters, they don't have a lot of knowledge that they're basing their political beliefs on. For these people, they've been having these feelings just in response to the news. When they're in a vulnerable economic position, as they've been particularly since the 2008-2009 recession, what's been happening? Well, they keep reading these stories about immigrants coming into the across the border, and then they have access to various social welfare programs, and this makes them mad. And then when they see Muslims growing, Muslim terrorists blowing up buildings and killing people around the world, this makes them mad. And they hear from the mainstream media, oh, you shouldn't be having these views. And then Donald Trump comes along, and what does he do? He reflects their own worldview, and he's connecting powerfully with them because he is basically making them feel smart. People outside the Trump campaign think that all these Trump voters are idiots. And actually, the Trump voters are thinking that they're really smart because here's this billionaire, very successful person who's confirming the views that they have in their gut. That's what all politicians and voters wind up doing. But Trump, by hitting these this fear button that he's been here hitting with immigrants and with Muslims, it's the fear button of the fear of the outsider. He's been connecting powerfully with people. So it's not a surprise to me. Now, I'm not saying that he's going to go on and win the Republican nomination. It depends if he can turn out these voters. If he can turn them out at the polls, he will be the Republican nominee. But who knows if he's going to be able to turn them out. Low-information voters typically don't follow through and attend caucuses like in Iowa. They don't follow through and actually vote in primary states.
So it doesn't really matter. So using an example, when he says we're going to build a wall between Mexico and the United States and we're going to make the Mexican government pay for it. I mean, it is not going to happen. I'll just say that loud and clear. But what you're saying is with his voters, because it's more about their gut feeling and someone who expresses whatever worldview that they have, that that doesn't really matter. It doesn't really compute.
Exactly. Yeah. It doesn't. I do hope that somewhere in the hour I can end on a or at least inject a hopeful note here, because I can tell your listeners are probably wanting to slit their throats right now. I gave this lecture at the Smithsonian last night, and I said to him, okay, for three-fourths of this lecture, I'm going to bring you really low. But I promise at the end, I'm going to bring you back up, and you're going to feel confident. You're going to be optimistic. So I want to make sure that we get to that point, because I don't want anybody committing Harry Carey.
No, indeed.
Yeah,
we do not like that to happen. Well, I mean, is it – and a lot of people want to join the conversation. But is it really about – I mean, in all things, I think, psychological, about self-knowledge, self-awareness, being aware of what one's instincts are so you can say, oh, there I go again.
Ah, that's the key. So back in the 1960s, we had a consumer revolution. And what was all that about? That was about educating the American voter about the ways that corporations were trying to manipulate them. This is what Ralph Nader's book, Unsafe at Any Speed, about the dangerous Corvair, which is this car that was
a danger
to anybody, if you remember it.
Danger to anybody
who got into it. Exactly. Well, we went through this whole consumer revolution where people got savvy. Now, the corporations are still trying to manipulate people. You walk into a grocery store and the goods that are put there at eye level, they didn't just happen to be there by accident. It's a whole strategy of how to manipulate the consumer. But at least now we've been educated to the point where we understand the game. And we're fairly sophisticated about it. What we need is a voter revolution. And I'm not an activist, so I'm not going to get in the front of the parade and lead this revolution. But it'd be nice if we had a new Ralph Nader come along and say, hey, we need to educate ourselves about our instinctive responses to politicians so that we can't be manipulated. And that's really what the whole book is about. It's about educating us to the ways our brain leads us to be manipulated by politicians.
Let me ask you one more question, and this has to do with the candidate debates. I believe there's one next week, a Republican debate next week. Now, this gives us a chance with that camera. You know, the camera sits on the face, and you may not know the person, but you feel you're certainly closer to them than you would be if you were at some kind of rally somewhere. If we don't know them and we feel like we don't understand them, but we can see their faces, we can see their body language. Is that helpful at all?
It's not really helpful, because what happens is that, according to the studies that I cite in the book, within 167 milliseconds of viewing somebody, just a still photo of somebody, within 167 milliseconds, you've already made up your mind.
Snap judgment.
Yeah, it's a snap judgment. And that's faster than you can blink your eye. That's how fast the human brain is operating. It's operating at, you know, Star Trek warp speed. And if you give somebody longer period of time, they don't reevaluate that instant evaluation. They simply dream up more reasons why that instant evaluation was correct. And all of this is happening outside of conscious awareness. 98% of what your brain does happens outside of conscious awareness. So consciousness is only about 2% of your brain. And what that means is that we're not even aware of why we believe what we believe.
Hmm.
And once we do settle on a belief, which we do instantaneously, all the rest of our consciousness is about coming up with rationalizations to explain the view that the rest of our brain really was leading us to believe. Now, this does not mean we're just, you know, like draft animals and we're just taken, you know, dumb to the slaughterhouse of opinion and there's nothing we can do about it. We can reflect. We can take charge of our amygdala emotional response, according to Joseph Ledoux, who's the leading neuroscientist in this area. We can, through higher order cognitive thinking, inhibit the effect that our automatic amygdala response has to the information that we are digesting constantly. But you have to be aware of that, and you have to make a conscious effort about it. So that's part of what I'm pleading for in the book, is to have people do that.
Let me see what Charles from Southwest Philadelphia has to say. Charles, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, your point about Trump was really good. In fact, Howard Zinn writes about that same phenomenon in A People's History of the United States. But what I wanted to ask you was, and maybe it's the crescendo at the end of this hour for hope, how do people actually change that confirmation bias if we are an amalgamation of a lot of different inputs in societal, racial, religion, all that kind of stuff. How do we actually go about changing that so that we can become a more informed voter?
Thank you. You're welcome, Charles. It's a good question. You want to take that, Rick?
Sure. Let's start offering some hope here. So first of all, a concrete step is to diversify the sources of information that you're exposed to. Through framing effects, we know that the human brain basically globs on to whatever information is around it when it wants to make an argument. So if you have just read a story about John Kennedy's philandering, and then you walk into a room where a bunch of people are talking about presidents who were philanderers, you will have just had this information in your mind. It will be fresh in your mind, and all of a sudden words will start coming out of your mouth as if you'd really given this some thought, and you'll be drawing on this new source of information that you just had. So the sources of information that we have are very, very important. So this is a choice. This is something within your control. It's not an automatic preference. You get to decide what sources of information you're going to expose yourself to. So you have control over that, and you should make great use of it. And by the way, if you were in this room and you were talking to somebody and you drew on this information about a philandering John Kennedy, the fact that you now started to enunciate a viewpoint, even if before you hadn't believed it, now that you're enunciating it and you're putting forth that as an argument, you will convince yourself that it's true.
Hold on to only because we have to take another short break, and that's
okay.
Rick Schenkman, our guest in this hour of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. He's got a new book called Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. This is his seventh book, and he's the founder of the History News Network. That's a website devoted to historians discussing current events. We are talking about evolutionary psychology and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane here in Philadelphia talking with Rick Schenkman. He's at the NPR studio in New York. He's the author of a number of books, including one called Just How Stupid Are We? Facing the Truth About the American Voter, Presidential Ambition Gaining Power at Any Cost. And he's got a new book called Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. An explosion of phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Rick, let me read an email from Paul who says, I noticed that some voters seem to have opposed President Obama based solely on his race. Also, I notice some of my own Jewish tribe, in quotations, support candidates who say they are pro-Israel for that reason alone, even if they oppose women's rights and climate science. Does your guest have any comments on this? I mean, this, I guess, gets us back to this the sort of tribal nature of politics and how we identify with, I guess, issues and also with candidates.
We do. And, you know, during the entire 7 years of the Obama administration, we've seen this tribalism in evidence. When Sarah Palin and John McCain started talking about we want to take our country back, isn't that what this was about? And that is just part of politics. When John Kennedy ran for president, Catholics naturally were drawn to his candidacy simply because he was a Catholic and no Catholic had ever been elected president. And that's true of Barack Obama. He got something like, I think, 98% of the black vote when he ran in 2008 and again in 2012. That's just natural. That's just human beings. When Joseph Lieberman ran as vice president, he got a lot of Jewish support. Now, there were a lot of Jews who disagreed with his support for the Iraq War, and so they broke with him. But we do have a natural tendency to support somebody who looks like us and talks like us. And that creates a problem, not just in American politics, but in the area in the arena of foreign policy.
Mm.
Why do we turn foreigners into abstractions and not real people? Because of tribalism. They don't look like us and they don't talk like us. So when a politician stands up and says, we had to bomb the hell out of ISIS and we ought to carpet bomb them the way Ted Cruz did a couple of weeks ago, and we don't think about the consequences on the civilians on the ground who are going to get injured or killed, that's because they're abstractions to us. They're not people who look like us or talk like us. They're not part of our tribe. So we're much, much more likely to let bad things happen to them.
Well, speaking of Ted Cruz, interestingly, Donald Trump has raised questions about the fact of his origins, you know, whether he is the other or not. This is something, of course, that Donald Trump did with President Obama and his birth certificate. Is that sort of this primitive politics that we've been talking about?
It absolutely is. I mean, that is what the whole libel against Obama being a Muslim born in Kenya and somehow he is the other. That is exactly what that is all about. One of the points that I think it's important to keep in mind is that when Donald Trump is appealing to people's fears of the other, he's doing something more than just activating a fear response. It's something very, very specific. There is an evolved psychological mechanism that has been identified by social scientists in studies of involving people around the world. So it applies to all human beings, not just Americans. And it has to do with our fire alarm bias. When we hear a fire alarm go off, we instantly react. Our eyes widen. Our nostrils flare a little bit. Our hearing suddenly becomes acute. Our heart starts to pitter-patter faster. We're racing. Our nervous system goes into overdrive. We want to understand what is the threat. Donald Trump has been activating that fire alarm bias constantly with Muslims and immigrants. So it's a very specific thing. And what is it? We human beings were evolved to have a strong fire alarm bias because if you miss a fire alarm, your very survival could be at stake. You might get killed. And if you have a false alarm, you know, the fire alarm goes off and you're in an office building and you all file out and you go out on the sidewalk for a second. Okay, you've lost a couple of minutes of work, but you file back in. Meh. There's no real downside to it. So this is what demagogues do all the time. This is what Joe McCarthy was all about. We think he's, you know, he's on the communist witch hunt and everything. We need to understand what the psychology behind that was. And the psychology was the fire alarm bias. He identified a couple of hundred people who he said were in the federal government who were communists, and they were working at odds with the American government. Well, what that was about was triggering this fire alarm bias. We want to make sure that we don't miss the alarm.
Well, let me get some more callers in. Looks like we have Karen from Audubon joining us on radio on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Go ahead, Karen.
Hi there. Do some people have a stronger brain reward system than other people for rewarding pre-existing beliefs?
Does this vary from person to person, Rick, do you think? Yeah. Thanks, Karen, for calling in. Do you think this is a human condition or it shows up in some people more than others, Rick?
Well, I think both. It is a human condition. It's one of the evolved psychological mechanisms that all human beings come with, unless you're a psychopath, and in which case some of these mechanisms are deactivated, like the empathy mechanism that all but 1% of us share. So everything in psychology is on a spectrum. So we're not cookie cutter. If you put 10 people in a room, they're going to appear somewhere on a spectrum of how intensely they feel one reaction or another. But that doesn't discount the fact that to one degree or another, their brain operates in a certain way.
I notice a number of candidates have been talking about addiction, whether I think Chris Christie talked about losing a friend to addiction. Some of the candidates, I believe on the Republican side, have children or family members that have struggled with addiction. What is the appeal? It's interesting to me, and I know this is, of course, an issue for many families in this country. Is that a way you think the candidates are trying to connect with people on a very personal level?
When we meet somebody, our brain immediately begins a process of evaluation. And one of the things that we immediately try to decide is if they're competent or if they're warm. And there's a social scientist who studied this extensively. So what politicians are always trying to do is get us to feel warm about them and feel that they're competent. That's a very, very difficult thing to do because our brain naturally wants to put you into one category or another. Either you are warm or you are competent. So they're trying to straddle that the middle. They want that sweet spot in the middle where they are perceived in both ways. So part of this is to humanize people so that they are regarded as human beings. Because so much of the time when we're looking at these politicians, they don't seem real. I mean, that's part of Donald Trump's appeal. He seems very real. He seems like, a bad uncle at Thanksgiving dinner who's just bloviating. But at least you get him, or at least you think you get him, right? You think, okay, yeah, I understand this guy.
Well, you say an interesting thing about Ronald Reagan and you know, the public much of the public or certainly a large portion of the public felt like they really knew this man and felt a strong connection to him. But as you write, he was maybe one of our most unknowable presidents, and even members of his family didn't really know Ronald Reagan. It's such an interesting dichotomy there.
We're really in sync because just when I finished talking about Trump being the bad uncle, it popped in my head, oh, I should talk about Ronald Reagan. And there you asked the question. So that's perfect. So at my talk last night, I showed a clip of Ronald Reagan, the very, very famous clip of him during the New Hampshire primary where he's caught on camera where he gets into a fight with the moderator who wants to cut off his microphone. And if you remember the clip at all, Ronald Reagan gets angry. And we've never seen Ronald Reagan angry before this, not on public, not in a public way. And it's shocking. And I've seen that clip probably 100 times now, and every single time I see it, I get a chill down my spine because it's genuine. He's genuinely angry there. And the response of the American voter to that clip was extraordinary. It may very well have been the thing that won him the presidency because it certainly won him that New Hampshire primary vote. So what happens when we see somebody angry like that? We immediately think we're getting an authentic view of who this person really is. And in this case, Reagan looked like he really had been wronged. So we not only viewed him as a human being, but we sided with him in this debate. Well, most of the time when we do that, we think we understand this person. And yet, wow, that's a lot of chutzpah. Ronald Reagan was one of the least comprehensible politicians and presidents we've ever had. His own son, Ron Reagan Jr., confessed in a memoir that came out a few years ago that he never understood his own father. Edmund Morris, who wrote a biography of Ronald Reagan, where he spent years on it. He spent hours with Ronald Reagan himself. He was in the White House watching Reagan during his 8-year presidency. He had an extraordinary seat from which to watch Ronald Reagan exercise the reins of power. And at the end of the whole thing, he decided, I don't understand who Ronald Reagan is. And he raced back to continue his multi-volume biography of Teddy Roosevelt, a guy he felt he really knew, even though he had never met him.
Let me get Dan from Mount Airy to join our conversation. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to backtrack. Your guest had talked about during the Watergate years how his lesson was that if you're part of a small insular group, you know, that's kind of the warning. And I think, like most of the enlightened movements in history have been small insular groups. Mm-hmm. Like he was warning against the, you know, being outside of the mainstream, you know, in a little tribal insular group think.
No, I think Dan, I'm looking at the computer here. You're saying, well, what about people like abolitionists who were, you know,
tribal,
I guess, in their own way.
Abolitionists, they're way outside the mainstream. They're very, very insular. I mean, strict constitutionalists today are fringe. I mean, like the people in, you know, supporting the Oregon ranchers are complete fringe to your average progressive.
Well, Dan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You want to take that, Rick?
Yeah, the caller's got an excellent point. And I wasn't as nuanced in my earlier statement as I am in the book, where I put in all of the qualifiers. Let me revisit that. Basically, what I'm saying is that think long and hard before you join a small group, because you are going to be carried along on a wave that's going to end up in a different place than you thought when you began. Even if you take a look at the abolitionists, when they began, they were not thinking about taking acts of violence like John Brown and killing white people in hopes of fomenting some black revolt and ending slavery in a violent manner. At the beginning, they were just driven by the moral cause of, we've got to get rid of this evil institution. So even they evolved toward kind of an extreme violent view, or at least a lot of them did. It doesn't mean don't join some small group. I mean, I think of gay people in the 1980s who joined ACT UP to protest Reagan-era policies on AIDS. They were a small group. And you know what? The only way that minorities can ever affect change is by revving themselves up in a small group, getting high off of the anger that they have towards some evil force or evil person that they've identified, and using that anger to create group cohesion, and that helps them get through all of these struggles and fighting the inertia that's against them. So it can be very, very useful.
Sure. Dan, thanks for the call. Unfortunately, we can't take Michael's call from Atlantic City, but I want to put it to you anyway, Rick, which is, how much does physical appearance impact confirmation bias? We have about 45 seconds. What people look like.
It's huge. If you see a man with a square face, your instant impression in that 167 millisecond period I was talking about earlier, your instant impression is, this is a guy who I'd want in office if we were going to war. If he has a round face, you'd think, oh, he's too sweet for war, but if times are good, maybe he would be good. And with women, it's a particular problem because we have both men and women have similar instantaneous reactions to a woman's face. It's one of the disadvantages of women that they don't have this square jaw thing going on, and typically, because it's testosterone that gives you the square jaw kind of a feature.
Well, we have to end on that note, the square jaw. Rick Shankman, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times, for Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Founder of the History News Network, again, a website devoted to historians discussing current events. And he's got a new book called Political Animals, How Our Stone Age Brain Gets in the Way of Smart Politics. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.